everyone. Welcome to the latest episode, if you've come this far. This was such a fun interview. Once again, they're all fun interviews. They're all interesting. They're all interesting people. We actually, and people could write in if they want, or they know, you know, people that know us. We were actually thinking about getting rid of these intros because it's like, do people really care? Can't we just go right into the guest? And so this could be our last intro.
Could be.
And we decided not to cut it because we're like, oh, maybe people like the light banter at the beginning. Get a little bit of Sean and Chris. Right now, people are listening like, nope, we could do without it.
We're good.
More to come on that. But Chris, why don't you introduce our guest?
Yeah, it's funny too, Sean, because our next episode of Pour It On is going to be about essentialism, which is sort of like, in my mind, sort of a return on investment question for a lot of things. And there is a question about how much value our intros add to if you've come this far. Well, so we realize that, people. We realize that.
Well, and it's interesting. There's probably a lot of people that might listen to this that don't even know what Pour It On is.
Oh, it's true. Pour It On is our other podcast that we recently started with two-time If You've Come This Far guest, Ben Feller. He somehow cajoled us into doing that. And actually, I'm kidding because it's been a real treat.
All right.
How does it work, Sean? Tell the folks what Pour It On.
Well, the three of us get together. We each take turns being a host and bringing a subject to the table for us to talk about. And the emphasis, really, the focus is on friendship, living a life that's meaningful and enriching, and just three older dudes having those conversations, which is really fun. And so we've published
eight
episodes, correct?
Yeah, the genesis was like we were talking about what would we do if we lived in the same neighborhood. I think we would get together every couple of weeks to talk about, you know, sometimes it's the hard stuff, sometimes it's the joyful stuff. And that's kind of what we're trying to do virtually, even though I've never met Ben Feller in person yet. And you have.
Yeah, I have. Yeah.
We got to remedy that.
He's delightful. And he's like 6'2" or something like that. That's the beauty. I keep saying, you know, people sometimes put their pronouns on their Zoom cameras. They have to put their height.
They should put their height
so they know.
Yes.
Oh yeah,
because if you don't know their height, it's harder to judge them. And really, that's what we're about.
Interesting,
right? judging people. Yeah,
interesting. Yeah.
Okay, so we'll leave the height off for now. I don't know how tall John Moe is, but John Moe is our guest on this episode of If You've Come This Far. John is a writer, performer, longtime radio host, as you'll soon be able to tell from his voice how that came to be. And he's also the creator of two of the most important podcasts in the mental health space. First, for a long time, he did the podcast called The Hilarious World of Depression, and then subsequently wrote a book by the same name. And then when that ended, he started Depresh Mode with John Moe, which, come on. It's really not even debatable that's one of the best names there is. Right. But anyway, what he's doing, and which I appreciated, and why I became a fan of his, and then why we invited him on the show, is he's changing the way a lot of people think and talk about depression, anxiety, resilience, mental health, and he's doing it through humor and honesty and empathy. And he talks to people. He talks to a lot of famous people who, God bless them, are willing to come and be vulnerable about these things. So, yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I'm a bigger fan of John's since we talked to him, and hopefully we'll keep that relationship and that conversation going.
Yeah, and I would just tell everyone, if they haven't, and you're listening to this episode, listen to his podcast, get the book, Hilarious World of Depression, is really good. And I just strongly encourage folks to maybe pick that up too, and we'll link it in the show notes.
You know, it's funny too, Sean. I feel like a lot of things podcasts, audiobooks, otherwise will put a disclaimer when there's difficult content in these things. We've never done that. I don't know that it's necessary, but I will say that John opened up with us and we talked a little bit about the loss of his brother, Rick, to suicide, and, you know, how that led to him realizing how, I think, silence and not talking about these things fuels the stigma. But yeah, there's a, we cover that ground a little bit. For those for whom that might be a trigger.
But we
bounce between the heavy and the light.
Yes, we do.
We talk about public radio voices that you brought up, which is hilarious. And he even brought up the subject of gorgeous ears. And I'll leave that for the listeners to wait for.
Yeah. It's if you've come this far episode that, you know, you've become used to if you continue to listen to us. So, it's fun. It is fun for sure.
Yeah, definitely some laughter. So, shall we?
Shall we? Let's John Moe.
Hello, John.
How are you guys?
Good, how are you?
Good.
I didn't wear my ball cap. I hope that's okay.
I just commented on this with Sean. I'm like, John's going to look at us two with our trucker caps on and think, what the hell am I doing here? It's nice to meet you.
These guys sneak in.
I know.
I'm going kind of low tech because I had to get a new mic yesterday, but I didn't think to order a stand with it. So I've got a mic resting atop a big stack of books.
Oh, that, you know, getting it done.
So I hope that works okay.
Well, we only have an hour, and I'm pretty sure that I want 4 hours or more.
Wow, okay.
But it's great to finally meet you. Thanks so much for agreeing to join us.
Sure.
And obviously, this is my buddy and my co-host, Sean, who you've known as long as you've known me now for 2 minutes. So, yeah, it's really fun to be with you. I'm not kidding when I say that I think both of us have become fans of you and Thwad the podcast and Thwad the book. And for my money, John, the best named podcast on the planet, Depresh Mode. I mean, we're going to talk about that later for sure because it's genius. Our show, you may or may not know this, our show borrows its name from a line in a letter from Andy Dufresne to Red in Shawshank Redemption, where he writes, if you've come this far, maybe you're willing to come a little further. Mm. So it's sort of, and this is where we're going to start here. I'm just going to throw you right into the fire. I think that quote and why we named our podcast this is sort of a call to action, which is to choose hope, right? I think that's what Andy was doing for Red in that movie, one of my favorite movies. So in that spirit, I feel like this podcast was made for a conversation with you. But I could be wrong. So I wanted to start just by asking you what role hope plays in your life.
It's changed over the years. I used to just sort of see it as a platitude, you know, well, yeah, you gotta be hopeful. You know, you gotta have high hopes, you know, like the ant and the rubber tree plant, et cetera. It's become much more of a task to me. And I tell people this all the time. If you sit idly by waiting for hope to arrive, it doesn't have your address. It might walk by, but it might not. You got to go look for it. And it's got to be a concerted task, and you got to take it really seriously. And so that means doing your research, whether that's an academic form of research, whether that is reaching out to people that you know or people that you don't know or people that you'd like to know. And I realize that's still pretty abstract, but it's got to be a self-care routine. Like you can want to take care of your body, but if you don't get out and run or ride a bike or go to the gym or walk the dogs, mm-hmm. You know, it's not going to happen. And so the search for hope, I think, needs to be just as concerted and directed as that.
Yeah, I feel like Sean talks about this sometimes in terms of golf and hitting balls, right? You kind of, it's got to be a proactive endeavor for sure. So I definitely appreciate that. If you weren't able to access hope, I feel like you'd have a hard time doing your podcast, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I mean, I the first episode I did for the old show, for Hilarious World, I interviewed Peter Sagal from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, who's a friend of mine.
Yep.
And it really wore me out. I mean, he's a great guy, smart guy, had a lot of amazing things to say, but he also told me about his divorce and the alienation from the kids from his first marriage who didn't want to speak to him. And, you know, I was in public radio for a long time. There are very few national hit public radio shows, and he hosted one of them. And I fell into the trap of, the hell does Peter Sagal have to be depressed about? You know, he's got the life I would like to have. Well, you know, he's got this horrible divorce, and he's got a genetic predisposition that he didn't choose, as nobody would. And so I spent this time with Peter, did this interview, and, you know, then spent a lot of time listening back to it, editing it, writing around it. I took a real artisanal approach to it. And it just wore me out. And I'm like, oh, God, you know, this friend of mine is in all this pain, has been through all this pain. And how am I going to maintain this as a show? How am I going to maintain this load on me working through this stuff? And I was thinking about that. And I was listening to one of my favorite bands. I went for a walk after this. Listening to music, one of my favorite bands, The Hold Steady. And they've got a song where Craig Finn sings about, you know, do you want me to tell it like it's boy meets girl and the rest is history? Or do you want me to tell it like a murder mystery? No, I'm going to tell it like a comeback story. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh my God, that's it. It's a comeback story. And I realized that all the interviews that I do about mental health and about people suffering and all this are all comeback stories. And sometimes that takes the form of that person was in really rough shape and now they're doing great. Sometimes it takes the form of that person was in really rough shape. Now they're in even worse shape. But it's still a comeback story because it's still, they still carry that hope and they're sharing that story. They're connecting with other people. They're trying to find something in the world to pull themselves out and pull themselves forward. And so to me, just the act of reaching out, of connecting, of sharing with other people is a comeback story. And so now, you know, after 70-odd episodes of that and 250-odd of the current show, that still really sustains me is that all these stories are comeback stories, and they all have hope.
So that was just a mindset shift that you sort of discovered, and you're like, and it doesn't mean that you don't still take on some of the emotional and spiritual weight from these conversations.
Yeah, yeah, you take on. Chris Gethard, the comedian, calls it psychic damage. You still take on the psychic damage, and I still, you know, I very, very rarely have I done two mental health interviews in the same day. You know, we used to, for the old show, when we had a bigger budget, we'd go out to LA or New York and try to knock out, you know, a bunch of interviews over the course of a few days. Even then, I'm like, we need to make it like a 3 or 4 day trip because I can't do, you know, two of these. I have to go back to the hotel and take a nap.
Is it therapy for you, John?
No.
Doing this show? It's not.
It's not. It's therapeutic, but it's not therapy. I gain a lot of insight. I picked up a new producer a couple of years ago, and he's like, such a side benefit of this show is all the help that I'm getting with my mental health. No, it gives me a lot of understanding, and you know, and I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not a therapist. Mm-hmm. I'm a person who asks questions. So if somebody brings up something that I hadn't heard of or hadn't thought of, I'm in a position where I can say, well, tell me more about that. What does that mean? You know, what, mm-hmm. what acronym did you just use? Can you spell that out? And so it's a strengthening thing. But it's not therapy. At the same time, it could be a little bit of a trap because I have heard so many stories that, and I have a habit. I don't want to say it's a bad habit or a good habit, but I intellectualize a lot of things. Like I kind of stand apart from them and kind of look at the, you know, I deconstruct what somebody's saying. Because that's just my way of processing it. And so I can fall into that when I should be really, you know, like in my actual therapy sessions, my therapist will say, okay, let's not talk about all that you've learned from celebrities or researchers. Let's talk about you here. So right. Something I got to watch. Yeah.
Do you keep count in the book of how many therapists you've had? What number are you on currently?
I open the book talking to a new therapist for the first time, and
right.
I've been with her ever since, and so that's been okay. About
she's 12 or 13,
yes, something like that.
Yeah,
yeah. Therapist number 12 or 13. She's not 12 right. or 13 years right. old.
Just to be clear for the listeners.
Just to be clear.
Right.
Yeah, no, I've been with her for a while, and that was kind of interesting where I, you know, made an appointment, and I came in from the intake session, and she's like, well, you know, what brings you here? First question. And I said, well, I host this show about mental health. And she's like, yep, I listen to it. I'm like, oh, yeah. So this is weird right now. She's like, yeah, this is kind of weird.
Yeah. Well, it is kind of weird. And so, yeah, yeah. So I'm curious about that. Just along that line, you know, listening to your show, having read your book, which is a memoir, right? I mean, basically, and, yep. you know, just how you react to people who think they know you. Because, you know,
like
all this insight, like, I mean, they're like, oh, yeah, hey, how's Charlie, Kate, and Marge doing? What's, you know, did Jill make breakfast this morning? What'd you have?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like, do you find that weird? Do you like it? You know,
it
just this knowing.
It can be a little weird. I mean, it's part of myself. Certainly, it's not everything about me, but it's a good, meaningful section of it. It's interesting when I was talking about doing a book. I went to New York and I met with different publishers, and sometimes like I'd be in there with a, you know, an editor or somebody who had, you know, maybe checked out the podcast once, and then often there would be like an editorial assistant or somebody who would just come up to me and put their hand on my arm and start crying. I'm like, oh, okay. This has been meaningful to you. And so I try to recognize that the public figure and the public service done by that figure yeah. is a version of me. And yeah. I try to be there for other people in that situation. You know, and that said, the book came out a few years ago now, and like, mm-hmm. you know, Charlie and Kate are both done with college, and you right. know, my youngest right. is yeah. about to become a senior in high school. So, you
know, jeez,
yeah,
time moves along.
I would credit you, John, with probably my what do we call it in the NPR world, a driveway moment? Isn't that what uh-huh. you call it? I listened to your book, which you of course read, and the part of your book about your brother. I realize it's early in the morning, but the part about your brother, I literally listened to, I don't know, maybe it was 50 minutes Yeah, I think I canceled a call to complete that part of the book. Obviously, really formative in the book and in your life, and maybe even in your career. Was that the big aha for you, or
a big aha about what?
In life about what your purpose might be?
Yeah, a lot of it was. Yeah, I mean, I mentioned in the book being at his service, and my brother Rick died by suicide. So yeah, at his service, all these people were not talking about how he died, or the mental illness, the depression that he had that, you know, caused that. And I decided, well, if nobody talks about this stuff, more people will die. If more people talk about this stuff, some people might not. Mm-hmm. Fine. I'll be a loudmouth, which is not common among Norwegians, but I'll do it. you know, and I have access to microphones. And, you know, so that was a big moment to be more outspoken. But then another moment happened a few years later, coming back from a camping trip with my family. My wife got appendicitis. She was misdiagnosed as having a stomach flu, so we didn't treat it. And then we drove from Wyoming back to St. Paul with increasing pain. We turned into an ambulance basically at some point to get to a hospital. And by then, she had gotten into sepsis. And we could have lost her. And I'm like, okay, this could happen to any of us, you know, not necessarily appendicitis, but like, you know, a bus careening out of control or cancer or stray gunfire in America. And so what the hell are we doing? You know, what are we doing? What am I doing with this finite amount of time that I have? And I was working on my first podcast about mental health, and I thought, well, maybe I'm here, you know, if there is a playbook that we're all running, maybe I'm here to help carry the load for people. Maybe, you know, the mental health is a heavy load for a lot of folks. And, you know, when you need help lifting something, you get a few people over there to help you lift it. And so that's kind of, you know, that happened a few months before the show premiered. And as we worked on the show, I kept that in mind. Like, okay, what am I doing with what I'm writing, with the question I'm asking, with the guests I'm booking? What am I doing to help carry the load for other people? And that's been informing me ever since.
This podcast is about being real with each other. And sometimes that means admitting life is hard. That's where our friends at Mental come in. It's a wellness app with tools and support for life's messiness. No toxic positivity, no gurus, just personalized, affordable, science-backed tools rooted in real-life coaching. So if you've been thinking, I should probably do something for my mental health, maybe this is that something. Visit getmental.com/IYCTF to give it a try.
I think, so I read the book on ebook, and I was at a point as I read it where you end a paragraph and you say, Jill was on her way to dying. And I'm thinking, what the fuck? Are you shitting me? And because I'm like, wait, his wife's going to die? And so you had already talked. And so I'm like, how much can this guy go through? And then you go through the story about how she didn't die.
Yeah.
But she was, it caught me as I was reading it. I'm like, holy shit.
Yeah, well, you realize at a certain point that in life that, oh, okay, these things aren't handed out fairly. You know, there are wealthy people who will have no medical scares throughout their lives. And there are people struggling to get by who just keep getting walloped by one thing after another. It's a random chaotic universe.
Yeah, that it is.
On the subject of your wife, John, when you and I first connected, we made the connection that your wife and I shared a mutual friend, Michelle McNamara.
Yep.
And I first like itty bitty question is that how you got connected to Patton?
I think I used that connection to land Patton the first time I booked him. We knew each other on Twitter, and so that was a little bit of familiarity. But I used to host this variety show, Wits, and we needed funny people who had written books at the time, and his book had first come out. So yeah, we sent out an invitation, and then Jill didn't have Michelle's contact, but she had a contact for a mutual friend between the two of them. And she's like, how are you doing? Wondering if you could pass this to Michelle. And the chain worked. And then Patton says that when Michelle got that email, she said, you have to go to St. Paul, Minnesota. And yeah. He's like, why? He's like, friend of mine from high school. They need you. And he's like, okay, I guess I'll go. My wife says I gotta go.
We're going to bounce between the heavy and the light and even the hilariousness of not hilariousness of, but the hilarious world of depression. But another light one here. I do want to point out that, I don't know, 4 months ago, Sean was gracious enough to loan my family his home in Palm Springs. And we drove down to what's the national park? Come on. Joshua Tree. Joshua. Yeah, U2 album. Yeah. Duh. And there's a famous music venue there called Pappy and Harriet's. Yes. And I was excited because the timing worked out that old 97s were playing. Mm. And so I took my 16-year-old guitar-playing, songwriting daughter to see your buddy,
Rhett Miller. Rhett. Yes.
Yeah. How did that whole how that friendship develop? Are you just an Uber fan?
That's another one. Quick aside, I was in Joshua Tree a couple years ago, and Jill and I were going to go see Max Sabbath, which is a heavy metal band that's dressed up as the McDonaldland characters at Pappy and Harriet's. And we couldn't go because it was sold out. But
and by the way, R.I.P. Ozzy while we're at it, right?
R.I.P. to Ozzy, yes. I got to know Rhett a little bit on Twitter as well, and we had a bunch of mutual friends. I think Anna Marie Cox might have introduced me to Rhett, or maybe John Hodgman. And John Hodgman introduced me to Anna. Anna introduced me to Rhett, and then we began following each other, and it was one of these moments, and I've had a few of them, where an artist that I've been a huge fan of for a while turns into my friend. And it's a little eerie how smoothly that happens, because when you spend a lot of time with somebody, Andy Richter from the Conan show was another example of that. I'd spent so much time watching Andy and thinking, I bet I could be friends with Andy, that when I got to talking to him in real life, I was very at ease because it was just like, oh, now he's made manifest in three dimensions. And so, Rhett was the same thing. I had been buying 97's albums since like Fight Songs in 95. And so, yeah. And then when my producer at the time on the first show also knew Rhett a little bit, and we're like, who can we get to do theme music for our show? We want somebody who sounds like Rhett Miller. Who can we get? And you're like, let's believe in ourselves a little bit more and then ask Rhett. And so he did the theme. And then when I was doing this new show with Maximum Fun, I went through all these different candidates. I'm like, but none of them have that spirit of Rhett Miller that I really want. Maybe I could go out to Rhett again. And so, he's done the music for both shows, and I think he's been on both shows. But no, he's a great guy. Although he makes me kind of mad because somebody that good looking shouldn't be also incredibly talented and nice.
Like, I couldn't agree with you.
That's just
more
hogging all the skills. That means somebody else isn't getting the skills. And that And then Jill had a theory that because Rhett's hair has always been long, that he must have funny looking ears. Like, that's why. I'm like, okay, we found
that's his flaw.
We found his flaw. And so when I was with him one time, I'm like, can I see your ears? Because I want to see if they're funny looking. Gorgeous. Gorgeous ears. Yeah. Yep. Flawless.
There's the title for our show. Rhett Miller has gorgeous ears. It is. Where's the equity in this whole thing? How does one guy get so much?
A chaotic universe.
And you talk about all these. I mean, you've had conversations with so many people who I am fans of, and that would be weird. Like, I'm a huge Wilco fan. So when you talk to Tweety, Gary Goldman, I mean, come on. Sean, I don't know if you've seen Gary Goldman's bit on alphabetizing this or abbreviating the states. One of the funniest things I've ever seen. And I bring that up, John, because I took my daughter to the airport this morning and had not listened to the Gary Goldman episode yet, which is very old, right? 2017, I think.
Oh, yeah, on the old show, yeah. Yeah, I've talked to him a few times since then, but that was the first, yeah.
Well, I hope, because I adore the guy as an artist, I hope he's doing better. But at the time, he was very emotional. And that strikes me as one of those examples where you're like, okay, I'm going to need a week and a half off after this episode. Yeah. Do you still have those experiences?
I try to be completely engaged when I do an interview. There is, you know, when I started asking people about their mental health in an interview, I was kind of nervous and it was kind of high stakes because I'm like, why are they going to tell me this? And it turns out because they want to help folks. But, you know, I always say that, I was asked one time, like, how do you get people to open up about these really personal things? And I said, I forget that I'm not supposed to ask them about those things.
Right.
Because mm-hmm. I've been doing so much work getting ready for the interview and hosting the show that it slips my mind that most people don't talk like this. And so I try to stay present in the moment. You know, like I still get interviews with like musicians who, when I'm talking to them, they'll say like, oh, and then, you know, I was in rehab for a while. Mm. I'm like, oh, okay, and it's not in any of my notes. And I'll even say sometimes, like, I didn't realize that. And they'll say, yeah, I hadn't told anybody until just now when I told you.
Mm-hmm.
And I get more of these moments, too, now where I'll book somebody. We booked Jim James for My Morning Jacket. And
love Jim James.
And it was clear as the interview went along, like, oh, he's a regular, he's a listener to my work. He's heard a lot of these shows.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so, you know, now I've done so many, I kind of know where the structure could be going into the conversation. I know how to make it flow and connect from one thing to the other, but I try not to do that as much as possible so I can listen for when, you know, they'll say, I did an interview that's airing, that might even air by the time this is out, where the guy said, I got into a bunch of trouble in high school, did some dumb things. But then later, this was happening. And I'm like, okay, what dumb things did you do? Go back and tell.
Give us the juice.
Yeah, yeah. So I still try to stay just as engaged, you know, and it still gets to me, but as long as I have that comeback story mentality in mind, I'm pretty good.
Well, real quickly, Sean, I just want to say that, John, we have no problem getting people to be vulnerable on our show. It's probably because we have dozens of listeners, or reality is hundreds, but you have probably two orders of magnitude greater than that. People must, though, know what they're signing up for when they come on Depression Mode, right? And I guess one quick question here is, do you feel like, I think maybe you even said this or alluded to it earlier, but do you think your guests are doing it out of a sense of mission and service?
I don't know. I mean, I think we book a fair number of artists on the show, you know, musicians, comedians, actors, and I think they do it for the same reason that the researchers that we have on do it, which is a sense that it might help folks. I mean, I think there's probably something to, you know, being more intimate and more vulnerable that helps your brand when you're trying to sell things under your name. You know, people feel like they know you more deeply and can become more invested in you. But I don't think people do it that, I don't want to say cynically, but for those reasons. I think before my show ever premiered, when I was inviting people on, I would just say, hey, you know, I think your appearance on this show is going to help people. And, and you know, I've always had if I can get through to the talent themselves, they'll often say yes. I won't share the name, but there was a very notable musician who we reached out to, and were told by their handlers, their reps, their publicists, you know, we brought this to them and it's just not a go at this time. So it's just, you know, we're not going to go for this time. And I happened to have the direct email of the artist. And I said, you know, I wrote to your folks and they said that you weren't into it. I totally respect that. If you do want to be on the show, we'd love to have you. And they wrote back saying, first I've heard of this. I'd love to do your show.
Oh, jeez.
So, you know, it's, I think a lot of people want to do something human and humane that connects with people.
So in reading the book, and early on, you're talking about you grew up in Seattle and grew up with depression, got hit by a car, got shot by a BB gun, thinking maybe that had something to do with the depression. So you talk about, you call them jerks. I'm going to say assholes. I'm reading the book saying, depression, living in Seattle, could it be any more depressing? Maybe go somewhere where there's sunshine. And that's where you would say, oh, yeah, the asshole, the normie doesn't get it. So one of the things that I wanted to run by you is I studied yoga as a yoga teacher, and this whole idea that yoga is about, and not really the physical practice even, it's about quieting the mind so that you can live as your true self. And, you know, the NSF has this study that is, you know, let's call it a quasi study, that as human beings, we have 12 to 60,000 thoughts a day that, 80% of them are negative and 90% of them are repetitive. So this, you know, we all have these voices in our head that are fucking nasty. Mm-hmm. And so the normies, you talk about the normies and the saddies in the book, and the normies are, you know, let's just say the saddies are people with depression. The normies are people that aren't. But at the human condition is fucking hard with these voices in our heads. And so what I wanted to hear you talk about is, is the distinction between for saddies, that voice I know is darker and louder and all encompassing, and yet still, when people, you know, don't regard or maybe say, hey, shake it off, they're not, I mean, they're, many of them, many of us have that demon. It's just not as black, right? Not as dark. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I'm trying to always evolve, like I think everybody should. I had a conversation a while back that kind of changed me. And it was with a researcher from the University of Chicago. And I had some question about, you know, does this treatment, you know, what does this treatment mean for people who have experienced depression? We're talking about treatment resistant depression at the time, versus, you know, people who don't ever have to worry about this. And he said, well, I think we're coming to a point in history, and we might already be there, where we dispense of the notion of some people having mental illness and some people not.
Right.
You know, just as you're not going to get through an average lifespan without ever spraining your ankle, catching a cold, getting a migraine, you know, messing up your knee, whatever it is. So too, you're not going to get through that without a mental disorder. And, you know, and again, I used to always think a mental disorder, like what's the threshold for, you know, like being depressed versus having a depressive disorder. All it means is it's disrupting your life. It's getting in the way of functioning as well as you think you should be. There's nothing chemical or, you know, there's no test threshold for it. It's just, is it messing you up? And so, you know, to that end, it sort of changed my perspective on what we're doing, and it made it make sense to me how when I started doing shows like this, when I started talking about this, I'm like, well, if, you know, whatever the estimate is, somewhere between 10 and 20% usually of people who have depression or have had depression, like that's awfully niche to, you know, make a sustainable show. And then I realized it's kind of everybody. And that's changed my perspective on it a little bit. I mean, in the book I talk about, what was this? No, this was after the book because this was about the book. So after the book came out, I heard from a woman who I went to junior high with, and she's like, you know, your book meant a lot to me. You know, hearing some of these same names and places that I was in, and, you know, really stuck with me because, you know, I went through the same thing, and she's like, I didn't know, you know, when I knew you in junior high, you were very gregarious. You were always the funny one. I thought, oh, he has it all together, not like me. Right. Mm-hmm. And I said, I remember you from junior high. You were a cheerleader. You were one of the popular girls. I thought she has it all together, not like me. And yes, I think that's kind of the world that we're living in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I think I shared with you recently, John, that I stepped off the board of NAMI Chicago and into the interim CEO role. So this next question comes from the best place, and I'm going to play a little bit of devil's advocate along these lines. I know a lot of what you promote and champion and talk about is, you know, fighting the stigma of recognizing that you may have a problem, asking for help, seeking a diagnosis. And then there is the other side of that coin, especially when you look at like the DSM-5, where, you know, it tells us how we're going to clinically diagnose all of the different mental disorders. Some people will say that there is a proliferation of diagnoses, right? Or diagnostic inflation, I think it's been called. Do you think we're striking the right balance, or we're coming closer to striking the right balance between like validating real illness and also, but maintaining a healthy range for normal emotional experiences?
Yeah, I mean, I think to a large extent, it's understanding that these things exist in the world, in the same way that you know, people say, well, why is everybody getting autism? You know, there wasn't as much autism before. I think about growing up, like, oh yeah, those were the autistic kids. Like, I remember those kids, you know, and maybe they had been diagnosed or maybe they weren't, but it was a big chunk of the school population that, like, oh yeah, that fits all those criteria. And I think it's similar with mental health. You know, there are, it's so amorphous, you know, and if you have one thing, you so often have something else, you know, like depression, anxiety, the Hall & Oates of mental illness. Although Hall & Oates are mad at each other now and not playing together.
Yes, they are.
I've got to change my
metaphor. It's a good point. It's a really important point.
But I think over time we're going to kind of see like, okay, so that's how that's presenting. That's how that needs to be addressed. You know, they're like, I think we're kind of at the dawn of figuring it out. And maybe the next step is not to, you know, now that we know how to paint, let's get not so broad of a brush and color it in a little more skillfully. So I don't think we're over diagnosing it. I think, you know, there's huge chunks of the population, often, especially men, especially rural men, who have a lot of issues, but are not going to ever seek diagnosis or seek help.
Yeah.
You know, I talk to a lot of people in immigrant communities. You know, and I'm from, you know, my parents immigrated, and you know, it was not part of the vernacular, both for immigrants and for the time I grew up in, to talk about these things. But there's a lot of pressure, probably more than ever before, with the idea of fitting in, with assimilating. And, you know, you don't want to stand out, and you don't want to portray anything that could be used against you. And so I think there's underdiagnosis in huge parts of the population as well.
Yeah, I just think back to the previous point, though. I mean, I think about mental health on a spectrum is, I mean, if we can just have, you know, curiosity and compassion for our fellow man, I mean, that can get us a long way. I mean, diagnosis, not diagnosis. I mean, how do we have compassion for the next person that we're meeting and understanding that struggle?
I think we've come a long way. I mean, I like when I started my first show in 2016, it was kind of a revolutionary concept, you know, that people were going to talk about this. I was surprised, you know, as I started to talk about it and write about it, just the reception that I got compared to any previous broadcasting or writing that I had done. And I'm like, well, either I just became much better suddenly overnight in all my skills, or there's a huge unmet hunger to talk about this stuff. And, you know, and we have come a long way. I mean, like, pro athletes talk about it now. Baseball players go on the disabled list for anxiety. And, you know, the first time or two it happened, it was kind of a story. But, you know, I went looking for stories about athletes missing time for mental health. And it's, you know, it's tiny little news items now because it's, you know, it's no more noteworthy than a sprained knee.
Yeah. I one of the things I was wondering about this morning is listening to you talking to Nurse Blake was, it just occurred to me, you know, you've been in public radio for a long time. Is there a public radio voice? Like, is it, it's kind of, wait, and this is what I'm getting. It's kind of kind, calm, doesn't smoke 3 packs of cigarettes a day, but maybe a few butts while, you know, it's having a cocktail at night. And so, can you just, either confirm or dispel that?
Yeah. Yeah. One sensible cup of coffee. Not 12.
Well, you got to have a cup of coffee with your cigarette, right? I mean, duh.
So when I started in public radio, I started first as a writer and producer, and then they needed somebody to fill in on newscasts. And before I ever got into any of this, I had been an actor. And so I'm like, okay, so I have to be a newscaster. I better just act like a public radio newscaster. And, you know, it's 11:04 in the city of Seattle. Traffic heavy on I-5 northbound.
There it is.
Yeah, I did the voice. Right. And then what happened was I was late getting a newscast together. Something else was going on. I had to quickly throw it together. I had to kind of, I didn't have it fully scripted. There were parts I was going to need to kind of extemporize my way through. And I forgot to do the voice. I talked about what was going on in the news. And as soon as I got done, my program director came into the studio and said, "That was great. You sounded really human." I'm like, "Oh, yeah, okay." And so I started filing stories for some of the national shows, just kind of freelance. And I'm like, "What'll happen if I just start talking like me?" And that led to a lot of success. I do another show now called Sleeping with Celebrities, where we bring on famous and semi-famous people to talk at length about boring things in order to put listeners to sleep. So, for instance, we had Paul Reiser, the actor Paul Reiser from Mad About You, and he's like, "Well, should I talk about my new movie?" I'm like, "We'll talk about your movie, but let's find another topic also." He's like, "Oh, I could tell you my thoughts on luggage." I'm like, "Yes." Perfect. Or, Kathy Valentine from the Go-Go's is a friend of mine, and she was on, and she's got a million very raunchy stories, I'm sure, about, touring with a punk band in the 70s and 80s. She talked about all the cats that she's owned instead, because those stories would keep people awake, but talking about cats would put them to sleep. So in that show, I go back to the public radio voice. "Welcome to Sleeping with Celebrities."
Oh.
"I'm John."
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, I tell the guests, like, I'm going to be in a 1970s jazz station voice. And there is. I used to tell people that the classic public radio voice is deeply concerned and somewhat constipated. Is what you're going
for that voice. Well, either way, I think we've established that your voice is a gift, if not a superpower. Sure. I want to touch on humor for a second, too, because I feel like that's also a gift. It's been a through line in your career. Was humor a big part of your childhood? What was it like growing up in Shea Mo?
It was a huge part of growing up, because it's something that we could all agree on. Like, there were things happening in my family. My brother struggled with what I think now is ADHD, but was just known as being a bad kid at the time. Mm-hmm. And that eventually led him to substances and an addictive, a tendency towards addiction took it from there. My dad had a substance use disorder with alcohol. There was a bunch of things going on, because life is complicated and families are too. But we would all gather around if there was something funny going on. Like if there was the Carol Burnett Show. Monty Python was on PBS. We would completely get into that. Those are times I remember everybody sitting on the couch together. Everybody, and we felt like a unit. And also, there was my dad was really funny. He was Norwegian and could tell a joke that you wouldn't realize was a joke until about a day or two later. Like, so dry, just bone dry. But he was really funny. And I began to understand that as a bit of a superpower and a bit of high intelligence. Like, if you can look at the world as it's presented to you, and then find something funny by just sort of twisting around a few things or asking a few questions, and a laugh happens and people smile, that's amazing. Like, I wanted more of that. And so You know, the work I do now, I end up talking to a lot of comedians, and you know, and that's been kind of a constant through my life. Like, other books that I've written have been really comedy based, because it feels like a way, if you can laugh at something, like depression, you know, even after your brother has died by suicide from depression, then I think you take away some of its power. Like, I think you pull the curtain back on the Wizard of Oz a little bit. And so I think it's a real strengthening thing.
John, when was Hilarious World of Depression published? When did it come out?
2016 through 2020.
Okay, so
that's the podcast.
Oh, the podcast.
The book was 2020, right?
The book was 2020, yes.
So what I found interesting, reading about your life and the challenges of depression and suicidal ideation, your brother's death, I mean, all these things that you've gone through at the end, right? The end. In this van on the way to get a new ladder with your son, Charlie,
yeah.
I said yes to the world. Yes, yes. Oh my God, yes. Yes, yes, yes. I said yes. 5 years later, are you still saying yes? What has the challenge been like since you finished that last sentence?
Yeah, well, I've had to keep saying yes, in part because soon after the book came out, the podcast got canceled and I lost my job.
Right.
And I had to go out on my own, and you know, I had an opportunity to keep going and own the show that I made. So the shows that I'm making now end one day when I decide to end them. And so I make those shows. I do so many different things. I teach writing classes. I produce podcasts for clients, for mental health agencies. And so I've been in a position now for the last few years where I need to say yes to life, and I need to say yes to myself more than I ever have. You know, because I have to every day get up and sell the product that has my name on it. Which is not all of me, which, you know, I'm not, I don't think I would want to star in a reality show about my life, you know, like I portion out what parts are available. But yeah, it requires confidence, and I am somebody with a chronic major depressive disorder. And so some days, you know, I really would rather stay in bed. I'd really rather just do nothing. And so it's a good challenge for me to have, because it gets me out into the world, and it's also a lot of hard work. So the hard work never stops.
Yeah, I think, you know, Chris, the way you started this discussion with John about hope, you know, and I've said this before, I don't think hope is a strategy at all. I mean, you use the analogy of playing golf. I hope I don't shank it and you know, that hardly ever works out. Yeah. And so saying yes, right? I mean, being intentional about yes, 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 I know despite the challenges of a, you know, a major depressive illness is very difficult. But if you can keep telling yourself that, it's got to help, right, John?
Yeah, I mean, there's a level of pragmatism to know the obstacle that you're up against. But you know, you're right. It does come back to that hope. Like, I've got to go out and gather wood for the fire. I've got to go out and catch some fish so we can have dinner, you know? Right. And so it is this conscious, ongoing, labor. You know, and
because you do live in a cabin in Minnesota, right? So you do those things. You fish for dinner, and you need fire.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah.
I envision everybody that lives in Minnesota needs to do that, right?
It's an ice house here, right? Actually, no. We've got the when I lived in Seattle, it was like 50 degrees any day of the year, and here it's been above 100, and it's been -27 during my time here.
Right.
So, you know, we've got It's layers. It's all about layers.
The only constant in the Twin Cities, as far as I understand, is that there's always the Replacements playing in the background, always, right? Isn't that always that's the only thing?
Well, that yeah, it's the people in challenging weather tend to start some really good bands. That's why there's so many great bands out of Seattle and the Twin Cities.
That's true. I've got a question stuck in my head that I have to get out. I think I remember in your book you talking about how Rick was better looking than you. Am I recalling that correctly? I mean, I find that hard to believe as I said.
Yeah, I'm sure I mentioned that. Yeah.
Your beautiful mug. My question is this, though. Who was funnier? Was it you or Rick?
I think he was more effortlessly funny. Like, he could be funny without trying. I think I was more hooked on getting the laugh, so I probably worked harder.
Yeah.
And I probably sold my jokes harder than he did, but he could just he could toss off something here and there. Again, this sort of Norwegian ability of like just going beneath the radar. I've always said, like, with my being demonstrative about my emotions and with me trying so hard to sell jokes, like, are we sure I'm not Italian? Was there some sort of mix up at the hospital and some hair dye installed? I'm not sure. But no, he was really funny.
We at the end of every episode, I'm so bummed that we're out of time and I have to hop. I have a few extra minutes. Before I ask you the requisite three questions that we ask every guest, Sean and I were talking before you got on. When's the next time you're going to be in Oak Park? Does Jill still have family down here? When can we have a get together?
Yeah, I got to get down to Oak Park. I don't know. My mother-in-law lives right in the middle of Oak Park now, like right by the big movie theater. And I've got to get down there. But no, it's a great place. Jill's secret is that she actually grew up in River Forest,
right,
adjoining Oak Park, but she doesn't like to tell people that because then they assume that she's extremely wealthy and she was absolutely not. So, we were in River Forest and I remember going for a walk and she's like, "That's R. Kelly's house there." Yeah. There's a big gate. I'm not sure what happens behind that gate.
Nobody knows.
Nobody knew.
Wow.
They found out.
Yeah.
Nobody knew, right?
Yeah, right.
Well, this is easy for us to resolve. You have your people talk to our people, and we'll get you down here, and we'll get together. And honestly, would love to spend more time with you.
No, I love Chicago.
Anything you think we should know or our listeners you would like to share with them before we dig into these last three questions?
Oh gosh, no. I mean, I guess I would say looking at what's happening to public broadcasting now and just all the cuts and the dumb politics and the layoffs and everything, I just urge people to support the things that they love and support the people who are making the things that they love. Like, I love it when people become members of our show and when they donate maximumfund.org/join, but that goes for, if you love a band that you discovered on Spotify or something, go see them when they're in town, buy the t-shirt,
yes.
You can go meet the band usually. We're done with this era of a handful of superstars that are unreachable. Like, it's much more working class and middle class now. So buy the vinyl, buy the merch, go ferret out your indie cinemas and go see movies there and support what you love.
I feel like you're someone I'd like to have a collaborative Spotify playlist with.
Well, he lists all the albums that he listens to and the acknowledgments.
That's true. Not all of them,
the book. No. The ones that he listened to as he wrote the book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? And so, and let me just say the things that I love. The book is great. So I encourage everybody that's listening to this to go get the book, The Hilarious World of Depression. Just very heartfelt. I mean, there's some very funny things. I mean, when you talk about this Rob Stone having worked in a Jiffy Lube, I was laughing out loud. Rob Stone, I think. So just, and it's very emotional. Highs and lows in the book. And so I just want to encourage everybody to do that. And a hell of a album list here.
Good. I'm glad you liked it.
Okay, John, you're on the hot seat. I know we're at time. Maybe you got three more minutes, right, and you can do your best at answering these quiz questions. What do you wish you could have told your 10-year-old self?
Believe in yourself even when you're telling yourself not to believe in yourself. Believe in the part of you that says to go on anyway. And it gets way, way better.
Amen. Amen. Question number two, John. Do you have a mantra in life or a mantra these days?
I keep, for a long time when my kids were younger, it was just the word patience. Because I had three kids with strong personalities and high intellects. And so I would write the letter P on my hand for patience. I thought about getting a tattoo on there. But now it's the word forward. Because with mental health especially, it's not a matter of getting over something or even getting through something. It's just continuing to move forward. Keep the car in gear and let it keep rolling.
Mm. Yeah, maybe say yes.
Say yes.
Yeah. Last question is, what do you hope that people will say about you at your wake, John?
I hope they'll share stories of when I made them laugh. And if they share stories about benefiting from something that I said or did, that's wonderful. But I just hope that there are a lot of laughs.
I really appreciate the work you're doing. And just great to be connected and spend time with you.
Sean and Chris, both of you, thank you so much for your time.
This is Chris. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of If You've Come This Far.
And this is Sean. Remember to check us out, mnliving.org.